So the theme of the retreat is building the Buddha land. And today we're going to look back over the ground we covered in the last week and also forward over the next few days. So we're building, creating worlds around us all the time. And those worlds that we create have a lot to do with our own inner world, with our states of mind. Some of these worlds are short-lived, others are more enduring. Sometimes we draw others into our world, sometimes we get drawn into the worlds that others have created, and sometimes we join with others to create a world. So, just a few obvious examples. Your room. You know, it can be a little bit disturbing sometimes, you know, if you look at somebody's room and think that this is a reflection of their state of mind. Family. You know, the world of a family. The world of a community, you know, a residential community. The world that we probably all had as boys, a sort of gang of boys playing together, you know, creating a world there. Sort of street gangs, the world of a school or a workplace, the world of a Buddhist centre, the world of a high street during the January sales. We could talk of the world of whole societies or cultures, some more or less healthy. And we can look at the terrible worlds that manifest from time to time, you know, such as the world of Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia or the war zones of Iraq, Afghanistan, the Gaza Strip. And if we walk through a city like London, it's as if we can transverse many worlds, even in a quite short period of time. So worlds upon worlds, overlapping worlds, interpenetrating worlds. So the Buddhist tradition speaks of building, creating Buddha lands or Buddha fields. Worlds where the significant formative influence is the wisdom and compassion of the Buddhas. So these Buddha lands, these Buddha fields are much discussed in the Buddhist tradition. And we are drawing inspiration for the theme for this retreat from a particular exploration of what it means to create a Buddha field, a Buddha land, that we find in the first chapter of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. The Vimalakirti Nirdesha is a quite remarkable Mahayana scripture, full of magic, humour and profound wisdom. And it was introduced to many of us by a series of talks given by Bhante Ergi and Sangharakshita back in 1979 under the title of The Inconceivable Imagination. It was actually the last full series of talks that Bhante gave. He'd given quite a number before that. And if you're not familiar with that series of talks, I do really recommend them. You can download them these days from Free Buddhist Audio. So I'm going to just read something of what the Vimalakirti Nirdesha has to say about building a Buddha land or purifying a Buddha field. The Buddha said, "Noble sons, a Buddha field of bodhisattvas is a field of living beings. Why so? A bodhisattva embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that he causes the development of living beings. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that living beings become disciplined. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that, through entrance into a Buddha field, living beings are introduced to the Buddha gnosis. He embraces a Buddha field to the same extent that, through entrance into that Buddha field, living beings increase their holy spiritual faculties." And he goes on to say, noble sons, a bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of high resolve, is a field of virtuous application, is a field of generosity, is a field of morality, is a field of tolerance, is a field of effort, is a field of meditation, a field of wisdom. A bodhisattva's Buddha field consists of the four immeasurables. That's the four Brahma-viharas: love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. A bodhisattva's Buddha field consists of the four means of unification. A bodhisattva's Buddha field consists of the 37 aids to enlightenment, and so on. So, just out of that, there's three points I want to pick up on. That the Buddha field is built by a bodhisattva or bodhisattvas. That the bodhisattva's Buddha field, the Buddha field built by a bodhisattva, is a field of living beings. And then that whole later list, a list of a series of spiritual practices. A bodhisattva's Buddha field is a field of spiritual practice. So let's just look at each of these in turn. But first of all, just something about the idea of a Buddha field itself, or a Buddha land. So it's worth noting that the word Buddhism is actually a word of Western coinage. The Buddhist tradition itself would speak of the Buddha Dharma, the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, the truth of the Buddha, or sometimes of the Buddha Sasana. And sasana is a very interesting word. It is most commonly used to mean the sphere of influence of a king. It's just as a king's rule would extend to a certain point, and then, no longer were his troops or able to defend the people within that territory, or no longer were his servants able to collect taxes or whatever. The sphere of that king's influence, rule, ran out. So we can also speak of the sphere of spiritual influence of the Buddha Sasana, the sphere of spiritual influence of Buddha Shakyamuni. And this Buddha Sasana has expanded and shrunk. It's shifted around geographically over 2,500 years. And you could say right down to the present day, we are experiencing at a distance the spiritual influence of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion. His sasana is expanding, extending over time, touching us right here and now. So this idea of a sphere of spiritual influence, the Buddha's sasana. So we could see a Buddha field or a Buddha land in the same way. The tradition also speaks of Buddha fields, Buddha lands, as being pure or impure. So probably one of the best known pure lands is that of Sukhavati, the pure land of Amitabha, in which beings can be reborn and everything there just supports their progress to full enlightenment. Our own world is spoken of, surprise, surprise, as an impure Buddha land or Buddha field. So we have this question in the Vimlakirshi Nidesha about the Bodhisattva's purification of a Buddha field. How does the Bodhisattva extend the influence, strengthen the influence of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion within a Buddha land? How does he counter the negative influences of greed, hatred, and ignorance within a Buddha land? So it's going to be pretty clear then, there's plenty of work to be done in our own impure Buddha field, impure Buddha world. There's plenty of jobs for aspiring bodhisattvas, even in a time of recession. So who is a bodhisattva? Who is the bodhisattva? Who are these bodhisattvas who build, purify Buddha lands, Buddha fields? We could say that the Bodhisattva is the ideal Buddhist, one dedicated to enlightenment for the benefit of all, for whom wisdom, the gaining of true knowledge and vision of things as they are, is inseparable from compassion. So when Buddha Shakyamuni taught, it was very clear, just from the stories of his encounters with people, from his teaching, that his wisdom and his compassion wove together seamlessly. But it does seem that, you know, the years, centuries passed, and some began to pursue wisdom in a very one-sided way, thinking they could, as it were, leave other beings out of the picture and just gain spiritual wisdom for themselves. So at a certain point, the Buddhist tradition reasserted the original true spirit of the Dharma, of the Buddha's teaching, insisting that actually wisdom and compassion are inseparable. The spiritual life can't be pursued in a narrowly self-concerned, self-interested way. That's a contradiction in terms. So the Bodhisattva recognizes the interconnectedness of all life, and in dedicating himself, herself to enlightenment, they can't but be building, purifying a Buddha field. They can't but be taking down, going beyond the barriers that define self and separate off self from other. So they're concerned with extending this mysterious influence of the love and wisdom of the Buddhas through the world. Which brings us on to the second point, that the Buddha field of a Bodhisattva is a field of living beings. It's not just a place. Again, it's perhaps obvious, you know, our Buddhist centres, they're not just buildings. Our Buddhist centres are to do with people. A Buddha field is beings in communication with each other, engaging actively with each other. So a Bodhisattva engages with others, works with others who choose to cooperate, to involve themselves with the work of transformation. And yeah, there's a lot of threads we could explore here. You know, the fact that one can't be compelled to participate in a Buddha field. It's a matter of individuals, of individual choice, of individuals choosing to commit themselves to work, dedicate themselves to the work of transformation. And that's the only way that true transformation can take place, true spiritual transformation can take place. We can say as well that we are together much more than the sum of the parts. There's much more to each of us than we think. Each of us is much more than we think. You know, when we come together, there's much more going on than we think there is going on, particularly when we practice the Dharma together. And, you know, just now and again, one gets glimpses of this, maybe in a really good puja or on a retreat, just a sense of some mysterious element is sort of alive between everybody. You know, a real sense of each of us being truly ourselves at our best, and at the same time connected with others in a very profound and mysterious way. So, a field of living beings. The Buddha field is a field of living beings. And then finally, a Buddha field is a field of spiritual practice. So, in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, there's a list of many lists of traditional spiritual practices that are set out. Too many to really begin to go into now. You know, but again, you very often find in the Buddhist tradition, people love these lists. They love to just set out everything. Often they try and include all the different teachings. Just pile them in. We're just going to look at two of those sets of lists on this retreat. And these two are the four Sangrahavastus, or means of unification, and the six perfections, or paramitas. So over last week, we already looked at the Sangrahavastus, and we looked also at the first two of the six perfections. So I'm going to give us a bit of a review, quick review of that territory, and then over the next 2 days we're going to look at the remaining four paramitas or perfections. Where we find these two lists together, the six perfections and the four means of unification, it's sometimes explained in the Buddhist tradition that the Bodhisattva first of all transforms himself through the practice of the perfections, the paramitas, through the practice of dana, generosity, sila, ethics, kshanti, patience, forbearance, virya, energy, effort, dhyana, meditation, concentration, prajna, wisdom. And then, with the paramitas well developed, imbued with prajna, with wisdom, the Bodhisattva goes on to build a Buddha field by means of the four Sangrahavastus, which are dana, generosity, priyavadita, kindly speech, artacharya, beneficial activity, and samanartata, or exemplification, or empathy. So again, the Buddhist tradition is very good at this, you know, sort of schematizing and systematizing. You know, first you do this, then you do that, and it all works like this, which is fine. But when one becomes more familiar with all these different teachings, one also can begin to see that almost every list in itself is a path. Each list itself describes the whole path, but just from a particular angle and a particular emphasis. So it's not necessarily always a matter of strict progression. All of these different sets of practices, they can all be practiced at many different levels, and I find very useful in understanding this, the template, if you like, that Bhante, again, Sangharakshita, has given us. Initially, just in talking about going for refuge to the three jewels, the whole process of engaging ever more deeply in an ever more heartfelt way with the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. So he lists the levels of deepening engagement as ethnic, provisional, effective, real, and absolute. And one can actually apply this template to most of the teachings. For example, to the practice of the paramitas. And just by way of illustration, I'm just going to look at the first of the paramitas, dana, in the light of how we might practice it at all these different levels. So the ethnic level would be, you know, one just gives because everybody around you is giving. You know, it's the done thing. You know, one's parents gave, one's friends give, it's just, you know, it's just something you do, a bit like sending Christmas cards or, you know, giving presents in the office. It's sort of, you just do it because it's the done thing. It's not that you particularly want to give people things, it's sort of, you just have to do it because you want to belong. Then the provisional level would be where one actually starts to give because somewhere one knows it's a good idea. You know, one's got spiritual aspirations. One wants to be a better human being. So one gives when one remembers. It's sort of, you're trying your best, but you sometimes forget, and sometimes you just don't want to. And But, you know, there's the idea there that it's a good thing to give. And, yeah, one's motives are inevitably rather mixed, as, you know, sometimes you give in order to get back and so on. But one's trying somewhere. Then effective level is where you could say one knows oneself well enough to know where one's values are in life. One actually knows that, understands that one is going to be happier if one has that attitude of open-handedness, open-heartedness, that this is something worth doing if one wants to live a richer, fuller life. And one knows oneself well enough to be able to sustain that sort of practice of generosity, knows how to cultivate it, knows the sort of conditions that enable one to sustain that practice. So there are still all sorts of forces at play, but one knows oneself well enough to be able to keep up a practice like that. A real practice would be when there's the beginnings of true wisdom. One's actually begun to see directly, intuitively, for oneself, the interconnectedness of all life. One actually just knows and sees that one doesn't really own anything. You know, there's still work to be done, but there is also this deep knowing. Actually, I don't own anything. Somewhere, that whole sense of a me has begun to substantially dissolve. You know, it keeps trying to reassert itself, but once somewhere, seen through it, there's that real wish to, as it were, share the resources of the world, to give of oneself. You know, that's alive. Almost, you know, a natural part of how one wants to live. And then the absolute practice of dana, generosity, would be when one was a Buddha, you know, a fully realized bodhisattva, when the whole sense of a distinction between self and other had been transcended, and there is just this sort of spontaneous play and movement of sort of energy, resources, it just this natural flow of kindness, love, concern that means one just spontaneously, as it were, passes on whatever one sees others are needed. So we can see, we're looking at a template like this, how the more deeply we practice the perfections, the Sangrahavastus, any of the Buddhist traditional practices, the more these practices become at the same time a means of both transforming ourselves and of engaging at a more positive, meaningful, compassionate level with others. And inevitably this means bringing people together, uniting people in love, harmony around the highest values. So something, the whole idea of what you do for yourself and what you do for others, there's no longer any distinction, and that distinction becomes increasingly blurred as one's spiritual practice deepens. And we can say just the same with the practice of ethics, of morality, the second of the paramitas, the practice of sila. So what we have in the Buddhist tradition, you know, it's not just a matter of rules and directives. You can do this, you can't do that. And we're probably all very familiar with the five precepts, both in their negative form, you know, not harming others, not taking the not given, and so on, and in their positive form of acts of kindness and love, open-handed generosity, and so on. So what we have in the precepts are guidelines to work with creatively, which allow us, as it were, to work out ourselves, discover ourselves through exploration, experiment, the best way to live, the wisest way to live, again, in harmony and compassionate connection with others. And in the end, it all does come down to the cultivation of an inner attitude. You know, the outer expression in the precept is, in the end, the outer expression of an inner attitude. You know, sometimes we can actually do things out there in order to work back and transform ourselves. You know, sort of examples are often given of, you know, for example, overcoming shyness. You know, inside one is afraid and nervous. One wants to overcome it. One knows one wants to be different. Out of that understanding, with awareness, with metta, one puts oneself in situations where one engages with people again and again. And out of that outer activity, gradually one finds the sort of inner change coming about, where one naturally enjoys being around others more and more. So we can use outer activity to work back, to transform our inner states with awareness and metta. But in the end, it is the cultivation of the inner attitude that's all important. You know, as long as people have greed, hatred, anger in their hearts, all the laws, all the rules, all the commandments that one will come up with, they'll still not protect others. But if there's love and understanding in someone's heart, all the world is safe. Shantideva, in the Bodhicharya Avatara, one of the great works of the Buddhist tradition, uses a very simple image for this. He says you can cover the whole earth with leather. Well, you can think about it, but actually it's impossible. You know, you'd never get enough leather. It'd be an impossible task, you know, to protect the whole earth with leather so you could walk on it easily. But all you need actually is a couple of pieces of leather the size of the bottom of your feet, and it does the same job. You know, so in the same way, we transform our inner attitude and the whole world is protected, the whole world is safe from our anger, our greed, and so on. So this discussion over last week of Sila, ethics, and dana in the talks opened up some very interesting areas for discussion that opened up by the speakers. Just really looking at our assumptions and attitudes about human nature. You know, there's a lot of ideas about nowadays, aren't there? You know, greed is good. You know, it's greed that actually makes for economic growth and prosperity. You know, that's what is in the end sort of, is going to help us all. Self-interest is the great motivator. It just needs to be tempered a little bit by law and convention, but that's what drives society. So there's a whole sort of set of attitudes there which, you know, we may or may not have been influenced by. And certainly the whole idea of the practice of generosity seems to cut right against those sort of attitudes. But, you know, do we really think that generosity is more than just a nice idea? You know, is it a really realistic, viable way to live, really trying all the time to be practicing generosity? And, you know, just exploring the area of ethics, the certain attitudes, again, that we can imbibe from the world around us. For example, the idea that, you know, we're all innately bad, you know, sort of somehow fallen, that we actually need moral rules, you know, we need commandments, ethical rules to keep the demons at bay. Or, you know, are we rather, you know, is our view rather that of the noble savage? You know, do we think that human beings are innately good and that civilization is the problem? You know, that's where all the problems have come in. there's New Age ideas, you know, that we're just naturally evolving, that the natural goodness of people is just going to naturally come through. And then, you know, within the Buddhist tradition, there's the teachings on Buddha nature. Again, quite a number of different teachings, actually, in different traditions. But, you know, there is talk in sometimes in the Buddhist tradition of innate purity. You know, how do we understand those teachings? So what are our assumptions and attitudes, you know, that inevitably are going to colour our practice of the perfections, our practice of ethics? How far are we fully conscious of those ideas and assumptions that we've just absorbed from the society around us, and how far are they actually affecting our practice of generosity, our practice of ethics? So that's some of the ground we covered around the first two of the perfections. So come to the four Sangrahavastus, the four means of unification by which a bodhisattva creates, brings together a spiritual community, a Buddha field, creates a Buddha land. Again, a traditional list. So the four Sangrahavastus, the first of them is dana, again, generosity. The second is priyavadita, affectionate speech, kind speech. The third is artacharya, beneficial activity, doing good. And the fourth is samanartata, exemplification or empathy in another system. So we find this list of the four Sangrahavastus back in the Pali Canon. There's a story where a lay teacher called Hataka comes to the Buddha with 500 disciples. So it's just an interesting aside. The Buddha seems to have had a number of very influential lay disciples, even in his own lifetime, you know, with many disciples of their own, for whom the Vimalakirti of the Vimalakirti Nidesha might well be a model. So this Hataka comes to the Buddha, and he has with him 500. 500 usually just means a lot, you know, rather than exactly 500. He comes to the Buddha with his disciples, and they're obviously quite an impressive bunch. And the Buddha's very pleased, and he asks Hataka, "How do you create such a community? What have you done to bring together such an impressive bunch of people around you?" And Hataka replies, "Well, I've done it by means of the four Sangrahavatus that you taught me, by means of dana, priyavadita, artacharya, samanartata." So this teaching was one that persisted through the Buddhist tradition, and that we find centuries later in the Vimalakirti Nidesha again being put forward as one of the means by which the bodhisattvas purify, unify a spiritual community. So let's just look briefly at each of these four Sangrahavastus in turn. So first of all, dana. So we've already seen this is also the first of the paramitas or perfections. And dana actually comes first in quite a few traditional Buddhist lists. It's sometimes said that dana or generosity is the whole foundation of the spiritual life, because it's with generosity that we start to reverse that tendency to refer everything to ourself, where everything circles around self-interest. Now, with generosity, we just begin to go beyond self. We begin to go out to others. And because of this, because of its fundamental importance, we find a lot of traditional explorations of dana. You know, gone into in a very thorough way, as again very often the Buddhist tradition does. So, you know, what do we give? Well, we give everything. You know, ultimately we give the whole universe, whatever is there to be given, whatever one can possess, one can give, even to one's own life, and most valuably of all, the Dharma. To whom do we give? To friends, relatives, the poor, the sick, but ultimately to anybody and everybody. You know, that's anybody is potentially the recipient of Dharma. When? Well, when appropriate, you know, wisdom comes in, but again, any time, every time, all the time. You know, we can always be giving. And how? Again, quite a lot is said in the tradition about how to give. Things like, give quickly and give without regret. It's very easy to give, isn't it? And then start sort of, oh, should I have done that? Did I give them a little bit too much? You know, easy to start sort of undermining that act of generosity. Give quickly without regret. So we've already seen that actually dana, generosity, what we're looking at is essentially an attitude, a state of mind, a state of open-handed, open-hearted interest, concern for others. But as a Sangrahavastu, dana becomes a way of building a Buddha land, so a way of building trust, building an easy confidence and warmth around others, a way of expressing friendliness and kindness, creating an atmosphere in which people can relax, you know, open hands, open hearts, where there is this sense of feeling in deep connection with others. And with this opening of hearts, then so much else also becomes possible. And we could say much the same of the second Sangrahavastu, Priyavartita, kindly speech. You know, we all spend a lot of energy talking. You know, so much comes out of ourselves. A lot of what we are is expressed in words. Our words have a big effect all the time on ourselves and on others in shaping, confirming, colouring our world. We could say kindly speech encourages, especially encourages the best in people. So this doesn't mean it can't be challenging, but it always leaves people knowing that essentially we're with them, we're on their side, we've got their deepest self-interests at heart, even if we're not prepared to go along with all they might say and do. So Priyavartita will include the expression of appreciation, of gratitude, affirming the qualities of others, and expressions of forgiveness, you know, making it clear one's prepared to let go, move on, give up. So then the third of the Sangrahavastus, Artacharya, doing good, beneficial activity, or seeking the welfare of others. So this can involve, you know, the many small or larger acts of kindness, friendliness and so on that take place on an everyday level. But more specifically, Artacharya is understood as teaching, communicating the Dharma, actually communicating the spirit of what is truest, deepest, highest, best in us as human beings. We can see it in terms of creating or setting up the conditions that enable people to come together, meet the Dharma, practice the Dharma, discover, develop what is deepest, truest, best in themselves. When I first came along to the FWBO, there was actually quite a lot of talk of building the new society. And this was seen very much in terms of centres, residential communities and right livelihood businesses. So over the years, the movement has broadened very considerably, and now embraces people who live in many, many different situations and lifestyles, which I think has been very valuable and important. But I think we have also lost something in somewhere valuing less those central institutions of centres, communities, businesses. And I was just reminded of their tremendous value just a few days ago when I got an email from a Mitra who lives in Odessa in the Ukraine. He was sitting at his desk and he said, "It's the season of no season just here, just now." And it was a bit of a limbo time. You know, obviously not much going on in the office. And he was sitting at his desk reflecting on his life, reflecting on his spiritual progress. And he was saying, you know, days seem to be going by, weeks seem to be going by, months seem to be going by, and I don't seem to be making much spiritual progress. And he asked me, might it be possible for me to come to England and practice more intensively with you there? He said, I'd even be prepared to sell my motorbike. And, you know, for this guy to sell his motorbike, that's a really big thing. But just, you know, obviously one wants to respond to somebody, you know, coming from a place like that. But I just realised, actually, these days there's not that many possibilities. You know, there aren't that many communities and businesses for people to come to. And, realised, you know, there is plenty to be done, you know, in terms of beneficial activity, you know, just in a very ordinary way, communicating the Dharma, but also just in creating the facilities that are going to allow people from all sorts of situations to be able to come together, practice together, really discover the Dharma deeply together. Then the last of the Sangrahavastus, Samanartata, exemplification. So the Bodhisattva creates the Buddha field, the Buddha land through exemplification. So exemplification here doesn't mean exemplifying, as it were, a fixed model of holiness. It doesn't mean somehow having an abstract ideal that one then tries to exemplify in an artificial way. What one exemplifies is somebody honestly seeking to go for refuge to the three jewels, honestly seeking to transform themselves, honestly working from where they are with whatever they are, to transform ourselves. Arloka, who's painted many of these pictures, used to live and work with us here, and he had a little phrase where he'd say, "Well, we're all a mess in progress, aren't we?" And maybe that's, if you like, what we exemplify. Honestly exemplify ourselves as a mess in progress. You know, honestly working with all our confusion, all our difficulties, but with real dedication, seriousness, working to transform that. No pretense, no preciousness, honestly, seriously dedicated to going for refuge to the three jewels. With Samanartata, there's an interesting shift took place over time as well. When we meet the four Sangrahavastus in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, it is understood as exemplification. But earlier on, when we meet the four Sangrahavatus in the Pali Canon, it was understood a bit differently. It was understood as meaning empathy. So in counselling these days, you sometimes get this list of different ways of looking at others. There's apathy. You know, when one's just indifferent to others, one's not really interested in them. Then there's sympathy, where one's sort of interested in others, but it's from a rather sort of self-centred point of view. You know, sympathy, somehow it's self-referring. You know, I feel really sorry for them, or I, you know, can really understand you, or whatever. Whilst empathy, the deeper, higher form, means that somewhere putting self aside and really entering into really feeling with, really feeling for another, really putting ourselves in another's shoes. And this isn't easy. We've sometimes done an interesting experiment at Gukhyaloka. I mean, some of the retreatants, this is where we have these four-month ordination courses, and some of the retreatants actually one year came up with this idea, you know, where we were talking about the exchange of self and other, of really learning to empathise with others, of exchanging ourselves for others by writing down what you'd eat each day. You know, so, you know, it would be start off with a cup of tea, bowl of porridge with honey and whatever, piece of toast with peanut butter and Marmite, whatever. And then you wrapped up the bit of paper, put it in a hat, and then everybody took out, or everybody who wanted to, took out of the hat, you know, this list of the meals for the day. So for one day, you ended up eating what other people normally eat, you know, and it's like, oh God, you know, how can he eat, you know, jam on his toast first thing in the morning, you know, or whatever, or porridge, you know. Oh, you know, suddenly we realise that other people are different from us. You know, they've got different likes and dislikes. I mean, it's a bit of fun, you know, in a way, not that serious, but actually, I think a really serious and significant lesson can come out of, you know, just playfully exploring with something like this. So, yeah, just really trying to feel for, understand others isn't at all easy. And it's easy to do it in a rather superficial, if you like, sympathetic way. Real empathy, real feeling with, feeling for others. You know, it does mean really working to let go of something of our own self-reference, to be able to feel truly for another. So, that's the ground we've covered so far. Over this next week, then, we're going to be looking at the practice of the Bodhisattva, building the Buddha land, building the Buddha field through the six perfections, the four Sangravastus. We're going to have a couple more talks, hearing about the practice of Kshanti, Virya, patience and forbearance, energy, and Dhyana, Prajna, meditation, concentration, wisdom, as well as all the other activities that we have, all the other practices that we have, meditation, puja, and so on. And also, you know, we are just living and practicing together. You know, we are sharing this world. So we can actually think in terms of, you know, not just talking about the six perfections, not just talking about the four Sangrahavastus, but also at whatever level we're able to, you know, actually putting them into practice. You know, just in the way we live together, work together, engage with each other. So we are actually practicing the Sangrahavastus, Dana, Priyavadita, Artacharya, Samanartita, you know, generosity, kindly speech, beneficial activity, exemplification. We are actually practicing the perfections of Dana, Sila, Kshanti, Virya, Dhyana, Prajna, generosity, ethics, patience, effort, meditation, wisdom. We're actually doing it together here on retreat. And in so doing, actually ourselves creating, beginning to purify, build a Buddha field, build a spiritual community, build a Buddha land.